My name is Clancy, and I'm an alcoholic. What? What? This isn't my home. I wouldn't live in a place where two people are missing in a mudslide. I got off the plane and opened the paper and said, two people missing in mudslide. Oh, shit. Go back home or they're... five people missing in a mudslide. I know. I'm very glad to be here tonight, glad to be here at this happy occasion of the 25th anniversary of the work done by the Hooper Place and its people and its staff and its graduates, who I've listened to with great zeal, and they all seem to have a story to tell about the transformation they've had somewhere along the line that at least was begun at Hooper. And I'm sure many people in this room have attended Hooper, and many people in here have not. I'm from a different era. When I got sober, there was no Hoopers anywhere. Anywhere. Or nothing like that. Like many of the people, the young man who just spoke, I stood on a street corner. I found myself standing on a street corner on a cold morning, somewhere a little, seemed as cold as this, probably wasn't, but a light rain falling. And I had just been physically thrown out of a Skid Row mission. Two guys had thrown me out and said, "And stay out of here, you damn bum." And I tried to explain to him, "I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write were running, the old L.C. Delmer ads for the Borden Company, were running that very week in Life and Time and Saturday Evening Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for achievement." How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for achievement? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. And unfortunately, about 3 weeks before that, a guy had kicked my front teeth out in the Phoenix jail. So I had a little credibility gap. Incidentally, I must say, sometimes we hear psychoanalysis put down terribly. And it really helped me. I was in psychoanalysis for several thousand dollars worth, as long as I could stand. And it never seemed to have any effect on me. But the morning I woke up in that Phoenix jail, and it turned out I'd vomited on somebody's bunk is what made him upset. And I was kind of resting on the floor, and he got cross. He went over and kicked my teeth out. And because of my work in psychoanalysis, I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking to myself, this son of a bitch is overreacting. Which gives you a feeling of one-upsmanship as you go along. But I stood outside of that Skid Row mission, and it was cold, and I had no clothes, and wet, and desperate. If an old man were to come over to me that morning and said, "You know, Slim, you're getting close to death. You're down near 100 pounds now. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your home. You had such a great career. People always said you were the hottest thing in town. And now you can't get a job doing anything, washing dishes. It's all gone. You've lost your clothing. You've lost everything. You lost your front teeth. You're an only child, and your mother is not allowed to collect phone calls from you because they're so tired of watching me build up her hopes and have them dashed again, which just kills her." He said, "Now, you've been in and out of AA now for about almost 10 years. Why don't you just admit you're an alcoholic and do something about it?" And if my life depended on it, which I suppose it did, although I wouldn't have known that, I would have had to say, "But you don't understand. It is not the way it looks. I am not an alcoholic. No question, there's something terribly wrong with me. Something terribly wrong with me. I have terrible feelings and terrible emotions. I wish I were an alcoholic. It'd make my life so much simpler, but I'm not an alcoholic." And if he had said to me, "Well, prove you're not an alcoholic," at that time, I would not have had the objectivity to be able to stand back and say, here's why. So I would have known the answer. So I probably would have had to take refuge behind bluster, which frightened people like me usually do, and say things like, "Oh, get out of my face. Leave me alone. Screw you." Because I wouldn't have known the answer. I know the answer now, and I've known it for a lot of years, but I didn't know it then. And I've known the answer here because over the years, I've come to learn a great deal about myself. a great deal about myself. I thought I knew all about myself. You know, it's an interesting phenomenon. You would think that you would learn about yourself by studying yourself, but you don't. You get more and more weird. How do you really feel? I don't know. How do you, you know? Oddly enough, in looking back, it's something, if you're kind of unfamiliar with the patterns, you'd think is really ridiculous. But I have found out that I have learned about myself over the years by working with others, by hearing my own thoughts come out their mouth and say, oh, that's what that is. Oh, that's how I sound when I say that. Oh, that's what that rationale is, you know, and on and on and on. You really hear, and you think, well, I was kind of lucky to find people like me, and that's not exactly correct either. I've been sober a long time, and I've been active a long time, so I've had the opportunity over the last few years to do some things that most of you haven't had the chance to do yet. And as I've been asked to come and speak at meetings in exotic places like Cape Town and Johannesburg and Berlin and London and Belfast and Paris and Amsterdam, and spent 3 weeks this summer in Australia and different places, in Costa Rica 3 weeks ago. And you'd think there'd be all sorts of exotic different people in all these places, and they're really not. If they be like me, if they be an alcoholic of my type, I'll guarantee you, when you get to the bottom level, they're all the same. You put the accents out of the way, the strange pronunciations, and you hear yourself coming through. But that takes a long time because, as the young man who just spoke said, we all take refuge behind that magic thought, but they don't understand. My case is different. I've often thought of, I'd like to be the Betsy Ross for AA and design a flag and wouldn't say, I need booze. Wouldn't say, give me a drink. They'd just say, but you don't understand. And then if we could be like all the other group of neurotic malcontents, we could march on Washington and demand our rights, except we'd all say, well, here we are in Seattle. Who do we talk to? That's rather cute. I think I'll write that down. Remember that. But I've learned a great deal about myself by listening and working with others. But I didn't know anything about that then, and no one came over to ask me any questions. And I was cold, and I was desperate, and I was sick, and I knew all about AA, and I knew all about, I'd been in drying out places. They didn't have they didn't have treatment centers or detoxes then. They just had drying out places where you go. And I had to get off the street because it was cold. And I remember a week before, some guy had picked me, I'd only been in town about 2 or 3 weeks, some guy had picked me up and taken me to an AA club. And all I remembered about it was that on the corner of West Wilshire and Fairfax, wherever the hell that was, and I was downtown, and I asked some guy, where's Wilshire? And he pointed out, you got to go up here to Hill Street and then cut left, and over 3 blocks. And I said, where's Fairfax? He's out west. And so I walked over there, this light rain falling, and walked, and found Fairfax and headed west and walked and walked and walked and walked and just got into almost just a trauma of walking because I had no idea how far I was going. I counted that later in my car some years later. It was 72 blocks. That's a long walk when you're sick. Not very funny either, so I'll thank you to stop laughing. This is the signal for I've said something funny. Remember that. This is tragic. I'd like to hear a muffled sob. Oh, Jesus, isn't that something? Yeah. And I came upon this club finally, and when I saw it, my heart sunk. I remembered, oh, God, that's a... It all came back to me being in there drunk. And I was in there denouncing them and telling them how lucky they were to be stupid and that they weren't intelligent and cursed with insights and knowledge. And I walked in, I had to get off the street, but they weren't glad to see me, and I wasn't glad to see them. And, you know, just hideous. I just hated it. And I... not only was it an AA club, which is bad enough, but this was full of AA fanatics. I mean, if you're new or even going through Hooper, you know, try to watch out for AA fanatics. They're a grisly bunch, you know. For example, now I'm not a mooch. I've never been a mooch, except when I've had to be. But I let them know, just hinted to them how they could help me meaningfully. I have no place to stay. and I have no dry clothes, and I'm cold, and I'm desperate and sick, and I'm hungry. But if I just had a place to stay and some food, perhaps, and some dry clothes and a few bucks, I bet I could really work this program. Do you know what AA fanatics say? They say things like, go to a lot of meetings, work the steps, it'll all work out. And of course the answer to that is, oh gee, sir, you're number one with me. And I hung around that dreary club, and that night there was a meeting, and I went to that meeting, I ate about 2 pounds of cake, just... And it got to be closing time, and it's still raining. And everyone went home, and just a guy was there. And I said, he said, you have to leave now. And I said, I have no place to stay. I'm cold and sick, and I have no place to stay. What'll I do? He said, about halfway down the parking lot, there's an old green Mercury left there by a guy named Joe Quinn about 6 months ago. Doesn't run, sleep in that. Well, you're really givers here, aren't you? And I slept in that hideous car that night, and I thought, this must be the bottom of my career. But it got worse. Yeah. Next morning I went in, went to the noon meeting, ate a pound of cake, listened to their crap. That night I went to a meeting, listened to their crap, slept in that car that night. This went on for a few days. And it's just terrible. I thought I was in hell. I thought I've died and this is hell. I wish I hadn't been so rotten now. And I had no idea then or thereafter that that would be my sobriety date. I didn't plan for it to be, didn't want it to be, didn't have the basis of anybody telling me much of anything. Just a sick, desperate, crazy goof. I don't suppose anybody ever slipped as long as I did and looks back and has now stayed sober as long as I have, who doesn't look back and think, what was different this time? What was really different this time? I would like to know that, really, not so much for my own information, but I'd like to be able to share it with people. Because I was a long-term slipper, people keep sending long-term slippers to me as though I have some kind of a magic answer for them. And I used to think years ago I did, but I don't. Nobody has a magic answer. I cannot transmit sobriety to anyone. It's a sad thing. Wish I could. I've always envied these people who get it kind of easy. You hear them say things like, I was having a terrible time, and then old Fred said, blah, 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 and after that, it was just wonderful. I never heard anything that helped me like that. You know. I wish I knew it today, though, because people, these old fools get sent to me, you know. They said you'd help me. It would be nice to be able to say, yes, I will. Just remember this. Never mind if the horse is blind. Keep loading the wagon. Oh, that's it. God bless you. God bless you. But I don't know any magic sentences. I don't know any easy magic way to do it. I look back and think, why did I stay sober this time? What in the world made me stay sober? Was it because I really wanted to? Did I finally, like some of the people who talked tonight mentioned they'd finally had enough. Did I really want to stay sober at last? The answer is absolutely not. Absolutely not. For a very good reason. The one time I'd ever given all I had to stay sober, I gave all I had, and I had a very good reason. I was in jail one night for some silly thing, fighting or something. Which is not where an advertising executive should be, but, you know, when you're full of fun. But I got thrown in jail overnight. And the next morning, my father came down to the jail cell. Did you have fun last night, son? I said, no, I didn't, Dad. It's going to be all different now. He said, I hope so, because your son died and we couldn't find you. And I felt so bad, I almost went crazy. And a couple of days later, when we buried him, I put my hand in his casket unobtrusively, and I took a little vow. This will never happen to your brothers and sisters, Clancy. His name was John. John. And I was working in Texas, and I'm down there working, and I drinking a little bit, because I needed to drink to feel like something for some reason. And my wife and children came in, and the pressure was on me again. I drank a little too much. My wife said, "I remember what you said about John." That's right. So I stopped drinking, and I took a vow. And I went to AA for a little while, but I couldn't stand it, the same old nonsense. And I went to a psychiatrist for a while and read some books and did things. And what happens to me is why I always knew I wasn't an alcoholic. I'm kind of a reverse alcoholic. Because I went to meetings again and again all over the country in my slipping days. And I believe what the people said. They said they used to drink a lot, they're in trouble, they got sober, and now their lives are better. And I believe that. I'll tell you something else. I have never known a long-term drinker who does not believe that AA works. I know some long-term drinkers, because I see them every day today, dying in front of me. And they all agree AA works. There's no question about it. I have left meetings with other guys like me and go across the street and have drink till closing time, and we all agree AA works. But it works for those people. It doesn't work for people like me. In my case, is different. We joke about it, but that's a lethal defense. And why does it work for people like me? Because unlike them, it is when I get sober and try to be good that my life gets out of whack. And that's when my emotions get so painful. And the harder I try to be good, the worse it gets, until eventually I just can't stand it. And that happened to me in Texas. The job I liked, pretty soon I didn't like. And the people I didn't like. And I'm tired of Texas, and the wind blowing, and the heat, and the situations, and the city. And I need to drink so bad I can scream. But you can't take a drink when you've taken a vow on your son's casket. So I didn't know what to do. One day my wife and the kids were in church, and I just pulled the car in the garage and hooked up a hose in the exhaust pipe, turned the motor, and went to sleep and died. I didn't know what else to do. And some old goofy neighbor watching this and noticed I didn't come out, so we went over and looked in the window, and there I was, slumped over the wheel. So he went in and pulled me out and beat on my chest and breathed in my mouth. They rushed me to the hospital and oxygenated me and examined me, determined I was mentally ill, and moved me to a locked ward and examined me some more, and determined I was a badly split personality, a schizophrenic with paranoid tendencies with a diagnosis, and committed me for an indefinite period up to the rest of my life to the Texas State Insane Asylum at Big Spring, Texas. Now that's how I get when I stay sober, folks. Yeah. That's not much of a goal for me, I'll tell you. I should say, though, I had a wonderful... I sometimes mention this... I was there about 2 weeks, and I'd been protected from the world, so I was feeling better. I thought, what am I doing in this place? And I found a way to escape, got through a door and down a corridor and over a wall, and I was loose. And it's an escape-proof hospital, however. I don't know if you've ever been in West Texas, but they can see you running for 3 days up there. And you feel like such a fool in your white bathrobe, just a matter of time the field guys just pick you up. Why, there goes that little Yankee son bitch now. And they snatched me back and gave me several months of electric shock treatments for that. And I'll tell you, once you've had several months of electric shock treatments, you don't run much after that for a long time. Do you remember my name? Is it property of the state of Texas? And the next year, I was still looking for a way out of there. And fortunately, they put it in an experimental alcoholic ward at that hospital. And when I heard that, my memory had come back enough so I could, because I'd been in LA for 6-7 years by that time, I could play alcoholic games with alcoholics easy. And I hustled that guy, and a month and a half I was out of there as a recovered alcoholic. And I never had another drink until I ran out of Thorazine. But I did not want to stop drinking. I look back now and I think, why did I stay sober? You know, it's an interesting thing. I've always been an emotional, very emotional person, as I've said about myself many times. I have not had a happy childhood, but it's been a long one. On. Sometimes I have to look around me and see what the grown-ups are doing and try to fit in. But I've got a lot of emotions. And I've had a lot of positive emotions and negative emotions, but I'm sure, like many of the people in this room, of all the emotions I've had, the one I hate the worst, the one I've always hated the worst, I don't even have a name for it. It's a halfway between hopeless desperation and terrible depression. When you just feel so bad, and you can't think of anything that'll make it better. If a guy would come in and say, "You won the lottery, here's $5 million," wouldn't make any difference. So what? Means nothing. And when I have those emotions in my life, and I've had them a lot, one thing must come. Eventually, pretty soon, I got to drink. I got to drink just to numb it. If I don't drink, I'll do something terrible. Commit suicide. And if that doesn't do it, then I got to do something else, which is even worse in a sense. I got to run away. Now, there's nothing wrong with running away, because I did when I was 15, ran away to sea in the Second World War. But I'm talking about a grown-up, the father and husband running away and giving all of his money and everything to his family. Say, "I can't stand it. I'll be in touch with you later. I got to get away and just leave." And getting sober does not change that. When you get sober, those emotions come back again. It'd be nice to talk about getting sober and finding all wonderful. But I'll tell you, getting sober intensifies the pain sometimes. And in my early sobriety, I look back now and I think, what a remarkable thing. I found myself, my first solution to that is one that I've recommended to other people. It's because you're beyond spiritual advice. You're beyond anything advice. There's nothing to be done. All you can say is, I've told a few people this, what it worked for me. Just stay in bed and pull the covers over your head. And it sounds funny, but you survive. Because if you don't survive, it doesn't matter how well you can talk or how much you know. If you don't survive. And I stayed in bed in my early sobriety several times and pulled the covers over my head and just wished the world would end. But eventually it broke and I'd get better again. I'm not suggesting that's a wonderful way to live, but I'm telling you, when you got to survive. As the old saying goes, you don't drink if your butt falls off. You don't drink because if you do, you're gone. But these emotions are terrible. I think about that. I said a little while ago, I've flown a lot of places, and I do. I've flown around the world. I'm on planes a lot. I was on a plane today, and I came into Portland, a cold, bumpy ride. And I'm not even going to mention the fact that no one met me at the airport. You'll never get me to tell you about that. There's a tragedy. That's it. And I went down to rent a car finally, and they didn't have any cars to rent. And I finally found a subcompact where there wasn't room for my bag, and so I put the bag on top and drove here. Little tiny car and big cars and trucks around me in this freeway. And I got here and they had no room for me at the hotel. I don't care. I finally found someone in committee and put a headlock on them and we got it all settled. But anyway, what I'm talking about. In fact, 2 years ago I flew. If you're one of the thrills, some of you may have done this. Fly on the SST. I went to Paris on the SST, supersonic transport. If you don't know if you know anything about it, but it's a very long, skinny airplane, only two seats on each side, but it's really long. But they're very fancy. They take off your shoes and massage your feet and put on slippers and feed you in French. And just, I had a hell of a time finding a cheeseburger on that baby. But anyway, up in the front of the cabin here is a big dial. And you take off and the dial goes to about the 130 position. And you go around over the ocean. Once you get over the ocean, that baby starts to move. It starts going around. And when it gets to 12, you're now at the speed of sound. And it keeps going. And you're way up high. And the sky is black. And you can see the curvature of the earth. And, try to look blasé. And it's okay when you land, though, at Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris. You hope we got good brakes on this sumbitch, you know. Boom! We're going to be in Belgium somewhere. Of course, that's just a joke. They don't use brakes on a plane. They use, what they do is all jets do the same thing. When you land, they reverse the thrust of the jets. The same jets that pushed you this way are now stopping you. So you go, They reverse the thrust. You may have a little handbrake use for the last 2 or 3 feet at the gate, but the main thrust is reverse jets. And it's always that way all over. I should say in passing, I don't usually say this, but I think you deserve to know how I happen to be in the SST. I sponsored a guy who would put the flag on the moon. And they had, a few years ago, the only convocation of Russian and American astronauts in world history. The only one. And they hold it in Lyon, France, at the Russian legation. And he came to me and he said, "You know, Clancy," he said, "we're supposed to bring a guest, but my wife and I are divorced. I don't know where my children are. Who could I possibly bring?" Let me think about that a while. Probably for your own good, you need someone to help you. So when we got to Lyon, I just did it to sacrifice myself. You're doing it on your own now, Missy? But it's an interesting thing. I've come to the conclusion, and we've heard it again and again tonight from these people, from different ways of expressing it. But somehow, how people like me, alcoholics of our type, I would call them, the only thing that helps people like us when we are fighting and fighting and fighting is that somehow, like that airplane, I must find a way to change the thrust of my pain and make it go the other way. And allow someone to use that pain, because if that pain can be changed, it can be used to make me to take actions that I would never take for love or devotion or desire to be good or anything. But the big hang-up is this. When you're in that situation, you can't trust anybody enough to give them that power. We all know that. When you're really feeling bad, people say, "We care." Yeah, I know you care, but you don't understand. How can you give that pain? How can you give the direction of your life to anybody who doesn't understand you and doesn't know you? And that's the conflict that happens from the first guy up here tonight, Ramon, talking about going through Hooper again and again and again and again, and the young lady and the young men. And they, how do you do this? It's so easy to say, "Well, then I did this." It just means nothing. I look back at my life, and I'll tell you what I am most grateful for is that I was surrounded by those AA fanatics. I would not call them... What is this, some kind of participation meeting? I really shouldn't be so smart till somebody pays for my plane ticket. That's okay, if you're the treasurer, clap and holler. But I'm glad I was surrounded by those AA fanatics. I wouldn't call them AA fanatics now. I'd call them winners. If you're kind of new and you're coming out of Hooper and out of the residential place and you're going out in the world, I'm sure they suggest you go to AA. And when you go to AA, you better stick with the winners. I'll guarantee you. Of course, the question is, who are the winners? The people who've been sober the longest? Not necessarily. I know some old-timers in AA that I wouldn't hire to mow my lawn. They look as though they have eaten a sour apple about 30 years ago. "I put the plug in the jug and goddamn it, I'm sober. And I'm happy." And the answer is, "Tell your face!" You know. I'll tell you who I conceive the winners to be. Those who are currently active and involved and doing the things and trying in their limited, fallible human way to be of some service to God and man. And none of us do it very well, I'll guarantee you. But I've got to remember those winners. They're activists. Because they saved my bacon. I can look back and see that now. Because I'm a self-pitying, self-obsessed puke at my best. I really am, you know. I remember standing around that club thinking, "Man, I'm sober, but I'm living just terrible. I'll never see my children again. I love them. I couldn't stand to be around them much when I was with them, but I..." I love him. What's this? Says he would continue. I said, time to go to the meeting. Jump in the car, Clancy. I had such a great career. I was a great writer. People admired me. Come on, we're going to help Fred move his furniture. Come on, we're going to help somebody celebrate their first birthday.
Oh, Jesus.
Just, I never had time to really work it out. And then, of course, you survive long enough, then they get into that other syndrome, which is really rotten. Get a sponsor. Time to get a sponsor. Get a sponsor. I said, I've had sponsors for many years. I'll tell you how you get a sponsor if you're a loser like me. Go to a community, find the best known AA there, ask him to be your sponsor, and then stay away from him. But you walk in immediately, they say, who's your sponsor? Chuck Chamberlain. Oh. Sit up front, let me get you some coffee.
Okay.
If you're going to call him after you drink. I want you to know I've let you and AA down. There's this actor came into this club, and I'd seen him in a lot in movies. He was one of these character actors, played loving roles, sat in the back, but all his uncles and, you know, character actors. So I said, will you be my sponsor? He said, yes, I will, kid, but I want you to do what I tell you.
Yeah, sure, Bob.
And I asked him to be my sponsor. And I'll tell you, he should have won the Academy Award for every loving, kindly role he ever played. Because they were foreign to his persona, I'll tell you. He was a right-wing fascist pig, is what he was. An AA fascist pig, the worst kind. After about a week of this, I could see that, you know, he didn't Does anybody else see trains going by here? Oh, there's nothing there. I must have been wrong. Well, we're on the right track now. Anyway. I finally had to explain to myself, I know, Bob, I know you mean well, but in my judgment, AA is not enough for me. I have deep psychological problems, and the psychiatrist that works on cannot find it. In my opinion, Bob, in my judgment, AA is not enough. And he explained that to me. He said, in your judgment? Who cares about your judgment? You're living in an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. If I wanted your judgment, I'd put my head in the back window and ask you for it. God, terrible. A couple times people said to me, why don't you just fire him? You don't have to take that crap. I remember going up to him once and saying, Bob, I want to talk to you. Yeah? Never mind. It's terrible to be intimidated. But he got me to take actions I never would have taken. He made me... The best example I know, I've said it a few times, but I know a better way to say it. At a coffee break of a meeting, where there's people... I hate public humiliation. Can't stand it. Right in the middle of the coffee break, he says, I want you to apologize to that woman. Why should I? He said, I've been told you called her a bitch. Never get a sponsor that has spies everywhere. I said, Bob, she is a bitch. He said, I don't care what you think, you go and apologize. And the worst part of it is, she could hear all of this and is sitting there going, and I thought, I'd rather have pins stuck in my eyes than go. I was about to tell Bob, you can go to hell, Bob.
Sorry.
You bitch. But he intimidated me into taking actions until finally I stayed sober a while, and eventually he got me to do things that seemed stupid. But I eventually held a job. I didn't quit when somebody hurt my feelings. I was more afraid of his anger than my boss. I finally, after about 2 years, I finally got a little job as a writer. And I remember going, I said, you know, Bob, I got this job at a medical corporation. I put this money aside. I'm going to get some front teeth and I'm going to make my move. He says, "You what? You've been saving money for your front teeth?" I said, "How about your kids in Texas?" "They got front teeth, Bob." "Yeah, that may be, but they got a rotten father, too. Send them the damn money." So I sent him the money. And I went to work at this corporation, carried my lip like this. They never knew I didn't have front teeth. I thought I'd been burned in a fire. But I went to work every day, and even by the time I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising for that big medical corporation. I had front teeth then. When I was 7 years sober, another guy and I were brought into Hollywood. We created something called Boss Radio. Became the number one hard rock station in the world. And we all wore shiny suits and said things like, "What's coming on down, baby?" But you get sick of pimping to teeners. When I was 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations for oil companies. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. When I was 5 years sober, same wife and all those children heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to Dallas, Texas, leaped out of their post office box, rushed to my side. 9 months and 10 sex later, we had another kid hit the streets. And now we're living together, been living together for years. All the kids are grown up. My wife and I have been married 48 years. No. My wife has been married 48 years. I've been married about 20. Is there anybody here, and I'm, you know, is there anybody here in their first week of sobriety? Back there. I just want to say one thing to you, son. This will make you, no, don't clap for him. Just remember this, son. I've got it all together, and you haven't. But I know you're happy for me, aren't you? And all of this is due to the very same things that people were talking about during this course of this meeting. Surrendering. Allowing someone or something to superimpose actions over your judgments. That's what makes AA such a hard thing to swallow for imitation intellectuals such as me. Because I want things that appeal to my mind. When I go to a psychiatrist, he says, "You come to us, we will change your thinking, and eventually your actions will change." And it's great, except they've never had any recovery ever in the history of mankind for people like me. AA says something that sounds much less attractive. They say, "You come to us, we will change your actions, and eventually your thinking will change." Now that sounds stupid, and you hate to do it, so usually you got to be kind of desperate. But when you do it, it works. Like the other people, I just had my birthday too. They've just had my birthday a couple weeks ago, for 38 years since I walked off Skid Row. Which is... I can see this, something going wrong. Start a love offering. A belated birthday gift from all of us. But what I'm trying to say is this. It all begins somewhere where you learn to surrender. And I believe and I hope to God that's what Hooper offers. A place to go and take the beginning surrender. If you can't accept the surrender, you're going to be like Ramon and be back on the street. And I'm sure most of the people, when they say 100,000 people have gone through Hooper, I am sure that the number of different people is considerably different. A great many of them have been in there again and again and again. And I know that to be accurate. When I was 15 years sober, in some hideous fit of do-gooderism, I found myself leaving a job in Beverly Hills. And for the last 22 years, I run the mission on Skid Row that threw me out in 1958. And people say to me, "Why would you give up your great career to run this mission?" And I always tell them, "Well, it was such a significant decrease in salary, I thought it was spiritual." When I was there this morning, I went to work this morning, and I got out of my car, and I did something that very few people in this room do. I have to step over the bodies of dying men and women, dying from alcoholism, to get to my office. And when I leave my office, I step over the bodies of dying men and women. And all of them have been to AA, and all of them know their case is different. And there's nothing that I know can be done. And we are not a treatment center. We're below Hooper. We don't even get people sober. We're just trying to keep them alive. We try to get them to eat. We serve about 2,200 meals a day. biggest facility in the world as far as daily meals. And we bed down people. And the nicest thing about it is all 105 of my employees are guys who used to be dying on the street. And they are working their way better. They don't know they're in an AA milieu. I know they're in an AA, but they don't. They're taking actions and they're working with peers, doing things that enable them to live in the world. And that's why I'm always glad to see any facility that says, now we have to put aside the philosophy for a while and start changing your life. Because until you do that, it's just all meaningless persiflage. There's all sorts of chatter and discussions and wonderful things and great breakthroughs, but they wind up with nothing. The last thing I want to say, I just want to take a little 5 minutes to say one more thing for those of you who maybe do, including my friend back there with a week sober. Because this is what I want to say, the purpose of being here. The most important thing I learned in the last 38 years of sobriety, I learned somewhere back there that I was an alcoholic. I did not believe I was an alcoholic when I got sober. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic after I got sober. But somehow I came to believe here. Now, how could I be an alcoholic when my problem really isn't alcohol? It is kind of when I drink, but I got so many other problems just to. And in AA, finally, I learned from my betters and people ahead of me and people whom I've learned to respect and admire, that is absolutely correct. My problem is not alcohol. If I ever think my problem is alcohol, I'm going to die drunk. And you say, problem's not alcohol, what the hell is it? The problem sounds like alcohol, and a lot of people mix them up. The problem here is something called alcoholism. You say, well, it's the same thing, alcohol or alcoholism. Not the same thing, significantly different. I'll guarantee you, if you be of my type, the day will come when your life and sanity will depend on remembering the difference. But what is the difference? Well, there's a lot of them, but put it in one sentence. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act. You are cured of your alcohol problem when you leave Hooper. But in this strange thing called alcoholism, this deadly, mind-eroding, bodily-destroying, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you will discover sooner or later, if you haven't discovered it yet, that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. That is what makes alcoholism a fatal disease. There's all sorts of ways to get sober. But eventually, after being sober, it gets so bad, it gets worse than the memory of drinking. But even that doesn't make you an alcoholic. That just lays the groundwork. The other thing is this. You must be one of the 6 or 7 or 8% of people in the world, and nobody knows how or why to this day, that gets an unnatural reaction to alcohol. But the sad thing about it is, you don't know it's an unnatural reaction because you have nothing to compare it against. It's like saying somebody to you, oh, your taste for strawberries is unnatural. They have no way of knowing that. Nobody knows how anything else is subjective. I don't know that it's unnatural. So the question is, how can you tell if it's unnaturally effective? Well, some of these old guys say, I stayed drunk all the time for 25 years. That's not it. No human body can stay drunk 2 straight weeks, day and night, in the laboratory. You always get sober. That's one of the rottenest parts about drinking. Makes you act crazy. You hear these speakers say, then I escaped from Leavenworth, raped 6 nuns, and then went to manager clinic for treatment. You know. I see people die today that have never acted crazy once. You got to hold a mirror to their face and they're dead, and they've never acted crazy once. More and more withdrawn. What is this unnatural effect? It is something I never would have guessed in 10,000 years, because it was a natural thing to me. Alcohol must have the unnatural ability to almost instantly make everything all right. It's an odd thing. It doesn't do that to most people. That's why they don't drink. It is not because they are morally and spiritually superior. It is because it doesn't do it for them. It makes them warm finally, and it makes them dizzy after a while. But then it never adds technicolor to a gray tunnel. It never makes them bigger and more complete and them smaller and less. Doesn't enable them to fight cops. To become irresistible to old bags who have turned into young honeys after film. It doesn't make them complete. And the trouble is, if it does that for you, you'll never find anything better. I hear people talk about narcotics all the time as though there's something magic. I've been working with narcotics addicts for 25 years. I'm not an addict. But I've been working with addicts for 25 years. I know as much about some of those drugs, I'm sure, as most addicts. I know about heroin, the great euphoria, the great wonderfulness of it. But you know what kills heroin addicts? Pretty soon they can't get there anymore. Then they got to take more and more heroin. They overdose. Pretty soon, unless somebody stops them, they die. Cocaine gets you way up there. Omnipotence, just everything is wonderful. But cocaine is the speed drug, and speed drugs have the same side effects. Growing paranoia, growing restlessness, growing discontent, and eventually terrible addiction, and the body starts to go. Incidentally, about you, heroin, I was thinking, somebody told me that where it gets, you need that so bad, you'll sign yourself into a hospital or a treatment center to kick the heroin so you can go back and have that effect again the next time you use it. I mean, that's lethal. Alcohol doesn't do this to alcoholics until you get to the last stages. Alcohol just makes you right where you are, but with the holes filled up and feeling different. And if it does that for you, it's wonderful. There's only one thing. If it does that for you, you're about to die from it. Today in America, where there's more sober alcoholics than anywhere in the history of the world, it is estimated about 95% of sober alcoholics, or 95% of all alcoholics, die drunk. And I'm sure they all die saying one version or another of the same thing. But I'm not really an alcoholic. You see, you don't understand. My problems came when I was sober. I just drank to get some relief and got a little out of hand. And they don't realize that's what alcoholism is. That's why getting sober and shaping up doesn't make it better. It does briefly. But eventually you must find something to make sobriety, first of all, bearable, and then tolerable. Now, I'll tell you something else. I get to my young friend back there. It's hard to believe. I wouldn't have believed this, I don't think. Eventually, sobriety becomes preferable to alcohol. Who would have guessed such a thing for a lost, wayward goof like me? So I'm grateful to be here tonight. For those of you graduates of Hooper, I hope you, if you're like me, I hope you've moved on to something else, or else I wouldn't think you'd be here. I hope those who are going through Hooper, or will be going through Hooper, you remember, Hooper is the great trampoline. But eventually, when your life is sober and your act is cleaned up, then comes the test. Because the world is out there. It isn't in here. There's an old joke that in the nut house I was in, people always, that's the only time my fingernails ever grew. I hated the nut house, but I was protected. It's when you go back out there. And that's where you got to live in the world with the emotions and feelings and situations. And that's why we have each other, to share our experience, strength, and hope. Because none of us are really terribly strong. And once in a while we need to grab an arm. And once in a while they need to grab our arm. And once in a while we come to maybe believe in a God whose symbolic arm we could grab and ask him for help. When that day comes, it's worth everything it takes. I congratulate Hooper on your 25 years. Hope you have many, many more. Hope you'll invite me back on your 50th anniversary. Hope you'll have someone meet me at the airport. Thank you.